This is a Stand Up New York Labs production, providing you decent podcasts since 2013.
Conversation podcast with funny man Damian Lemon and the voice of your choice, Ali Muhammad.
Yo, you are now in the conversation, and it's the voice of your choice, Ali Muhammad. And as you know, Damian is recording a season 3 of Comedy Knockout right now. He'll be back next week. This week, you got me, and I do have special guests, but before we move into that, I want to, you know, give a special shout out and and, you know, send out some good positive energy to a fellow podcaster, Combat Jack, who is just diagnosed with colon cancer. So he's on that hashtag Combat Cancer. So we're going to send out some special energy. Everybody out there, you know what I'm saying, put your energies up for Combat Jack. And, yeah, we're going to get into this conversation. How y'all feel out there? All right. So this week, we're going to do something new, something different. I've never done this before.
Neither have I.
I've had a... We're going to have a guest that I don't know at all. I was introduced by a good friend, suggested that she come through. She's a great conversationalist, and we're going to make it happen. It's like blind conversation here.
That's right.
So we have Dana Vincent.
Very good.
And she is a writer. She wants me to say struggling writer. But
as in, I struggle to write.
She struggles to write, not that she's just struggling, because she's a lawyer by trade. But she wants to move into writing.
Right.
So she's on the hustle and on the bubble, and she's gonna make it happen. And we're gonna find out a little bit about her. She's gonna find out a little bit about me, and hopefully we'll get to the heart of the conversation.
The conversation.
You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. So let us know a little bit about who you are.
Well, as I was telling you earlier, I'm Dana. I'm from Haiti. I grew up in Brooklyn in the beautiful 90s.
Ça passe.
You have to know this if you're a Brooklynite.
Or Miamiite.
Miamiite. Yo, Haitians. Yeah, Miamiite for sure. So I'm a Haitian person living in New York. I think we're all refugees, even if we never leave home.
I mean, it's kind of obvious.
Yes. Black folks were all in exile. But I grew up in the beautiful 90s. And I think sometimes we have to beware of nostalgia because that keeps us looking backward. But if we're going to be nostalgic, the 90s is a nice time to be nostalgic about.
No doubt. My partner here in this show, D. Lemon, he likes to say that he's a sucker for nostalgic marketing. So I wish he was here to have this nostalgic conversation. So you say the beautiful 90s.
The beautiful 90s.
And for you, what made the 90s so beautiful?
I mean, I think what made the 90s beautiful is Black folks loved each other. They did. Like, it was cool to be Black in the 90s. I don't mean, like, on a commercial tip, but, like, in our skins, in our bodies.
No doubt.
Like, Black people wanted to be around other Black people. Mm-hmm. We were eyes on the prize because of marketing reasons. We can't get a touch. We can't see it now because copyright reasons. Like, right. They have all the songs. But I was a baby of Eyes on the Prize. I watched that when I was in high school. The documentary series. And growing up in, you know, Eyes on the Prize to Larry Clark Kids, that which was a whole about young kids in New York City.
Kids, the movie.
Yeah. That's crazy. Like that energy after Bernadette Guest, the Central Park Five. So there was a lot more politics in the air. We own our politics. We weren't just consumers. I mean, I guess nobody had nothing. So there was nothing to consume except French fries.
Yeah. And then we were, it was a little bit, as far as media was concerned, we were... You know, it was on the fringes for a while, but in the 90s, it became, I would say, a cultural renaissance of sorts, you know what I'm saying, where you started to have a lot of Blacks on TV with Martin, Def Comedy Jam, hip-hop was hitting real hard, Queen Latifah, Living Single. We talked about this before on the show. It was Living Single, it was, what else was out there?
I didn't own a TV until 5 years ago.
You didn't own a TV?
So, I am not the TV girl.
You missed the cultural renaissance of the 90s?
I missed the television part of it.
You just lived it. So tell us about some of that life part of it, what you were seeing.
Like, I don't know.
For someone who wasn't there,
okay.
Can you describe Brooklyn?
Yeah, Brooklyn was beautiful. I mean, I felt like the Brooklyn Labor Day from, not Labor Day, Memorial Day, right? I went to Spelman College. Mm-hmm. So the beginning of the summer was Dance Africa.
Right.
And Dance Africa takes a weekend, downtown Brooklyn, which is now very developed. But then it was not so developed. It was so Fort Greene. And it was the Fort Greene of Nola Darling. I don't know if you remember Spike Lee's first little gem.
No, they're making a Netflix version.
Okay, I heard about that. So it was that Fort Greene was still in transition. Like folks who lived down there, it was still pre-gentrification. Mm-hmm. And I'm not necessarily anti-gentrification as a model, but it definitely was not... It just wasn't the Brooklyn that it is now.
Well, it was us at the time. It was a cultural movement. It was Spike Lee and Nelson George. And,
yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes. It was poetry readings, and everybody wasn't in the same rhythm. You can actually go out at night and see a whole bunch of black people in Fort Greene, mm-hmm. and know half of the people, either from schooling, from friends of friends, 6 Degrees of Separation, which 6 Degrees of Separation came out at that time. Mm-hmm. I was working for a nonprofit organization. It was called Youth Force. We were taking back the park from drug dealers. So Fort Greene Park.
How did that go?
Yo, that was fun. I had a great childhood in New York. I mean, it was a ragtag group of young kids from the Bronx, from Queens, from Brooklyn, and Fort Greene, the projects was the projects.
Yeah,
the
original 50
yes,
Cent was
yes.
from the projects right there.
So we would bring drumming into the park, movies into the park. And sometimes we would have shootouts and we had to pack our shit and go. But it was literally like we were taking back the park from drug dealers, because we were still coming out of like that era that the Wire made glamorous, but it was actually mm-hmm. very hard to live.
Right.
You know, I had an uncle who was a crackhead, and that mm-hmm. was not a beautiful thing to see.
No, it wasn't.
But there was definitely that energy of like, we weren't just going to sit here and be victims either. So this was the early days of HIV and AIDS, mm-hmm. like coming out of the gay community and sort of like being something that heterosexual young black people had to worry about. So we were doing HIV AIDS education, showing people how to put on condoms and bananas. And this is all
this in the park.
All of this. Yeah. When I was in high school.
That was a hell of a park.
Yeah, it was. I mean, some of the Wyckoff housing, for example, uh-huh. like there's a lot of the Red Hook housing. There's a lot of federal housing projects, South Bronx. We did this in the South Bronx. Just housing projects throughout the city. We wanted to bring programming within the projects, not mm-hmm. just have it be like sort of like forgotten cities. And we did this underneath the banner of youth organizing, and right. I think that's where I connect with, let's say, what connects Barack Obama to go into community organizing after college or after law school.
And you said you were in high school doing this.
Yeah.
And so what's one of the things that you learned from working in the park, dealing with the drug dealers and the crack era and all of the, you know, it was hectic back then.
It was hectic.
Fort Greene was hectic.
It was hectic.
That's where they came up with Brooklyn Keeps on Taking It.
Yes. Indeed.
So what did you learn in that process?
I mean, I think there's something called resilience and respect. Mm-hmm. And I think that I just, before we're consumers, we're beings. Mm-hmm. And I think there was something glorious to me about being a young person who wanted to be versus being a young person who wanted to consume.
Right.
Like, I wasn't thinking about, oh, can I just get this house in the Hamptons? Can I get this car? I was like, how did I want to be in the world? Mm-hmm. Like, who were my idols? And all my idols were actors. There were people mm-hmm. who, by actors, I mean people who had agency over their lives.
Right.
And it wasn't necessarily the person who had the biggest house or the right. biggest car or had the, you know, the videos were not, like, we were watching Video Music Box. Like, we're going home at 4 o'clock and watching just sort of like people with a camera in their basement. And that was the video. And that was fun, you know? So it definitely taught me, there's a lot about values. I think we start having a conversation about what we value pretty young. And if you're growing up where you're surrounded by other people who care about making a neighborhood better, mm-hmm. you just have a different set of values, I think.
Right.
You know?
No doubt. So You were in high school. You were in Brooklyn.
So I'm in high school. I'm in Brooklyn.
Moving around, doing positive things.
Yeah.
And soaking up the beautifulness of the 90s.
Yeah, but the 90s was also complicated, right? I mean, you also had Bernard Goetz shooting up people.
I mean, the 90s was kind of hectic in my world. It was beautiful, and we were having a great time. I actually, you know, started my first company, and we did a TV show. And we were having a great time, and we were traveling around, going to different black schools, mm-hmm. and kicking it with, you know. But at the same time, you know, it was a lot of drugs mm-hmm. and things happening.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you being from Miami, it's kind of a duality that's present at all times, that the streets is never too far.
Yes.
In that city, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? So it's like, no matter how... There's not a lot of separation
right.
between the classes.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's not a wide spectrum of black classes, mm-hmm. classism mm-hmm. in that city. So it's kind of like black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And
what about the Latinos?
It's usually, well, from my experience, the way I grew up and where I grew up in the northwest side of Miami, I mean, it was very few mm-hmm. Latinos. You know what mm-hmm. I'm saying? You do come across. You might have some at your school and mm-hmm. here and there. But the northwest section of Miami was pretty much black from 38th Street to you leave to, mm-hmm. you, know, to you leave into Miramar.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So you could have a total experience without ever having to deal with, you know what I'm saying, a culture that's outside of you
mm-hmm.
at a certain point after white flight. Mm-hmm. So. You go from Liberty City to Carroll City and just deal with nothing but black people.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And mm-hmm. that's your whole world. That's your whole existence.
Mm-hmm.
So I did come across them because I moved around. But like I said, my day-to-day, you know, was really black, Haitian, Jamaican.
Well, I mean, I didn't want to be a downer. But as a high school student, I remember a friend of mine had a big brother who was living in Miami who was Haitian,
mm-hmm.
who also was a young black man with schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
And he got shot in the back by the police. Mm. But this was way long before Black Lives Mattered.
Right.
There was no protest around that.
And then they just probably sprinkled some crack on them.
No, but it was sort of like, you know, we talk about Black Lives Matter, but like mental health life matters. And just him not being able to sort of like comply because of his schizophrenia created danger for him.
Right.
And it was the first time we had lost somebody at this young age. We were maybe 16, 17.
And that was your cousin or friend?
No, that was my friend's brother.
Your friend's brother.
My friend's brother. A cutie pie, too. But yeah. I mean, all lives matter. But.
But that cutie pie, Lord have mercy.
But yeah, I mean, that's my recollection of Miami.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. That was, you know, I mean, that's what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even in the Eyes on the Prize documentary, mm-hmm. they have a section on Miami
of
the riots.
That, but I trust that.
The McDuffie riots. Mm-hmm. It's a section in that. Documentary, because that's when we saw it in school,
mm-hmm.
and the emphasis was on the McDuffie riots,
the local stuff,
and it was police shot McDuffie, and he was on a motorcycle. I think he may have ran from him or something like that, but they shot him in Overtown, and it was a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they told us, you know what I'm saying, they tore shit up.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But
yes,
I went off to FAMU.
I went off to Spelman.
You went off to Spelman.
Right.
How was that?
I remember I grew up next to Brooklyn College. Mm-hmm. And Brooklyn College is in the heart of Flatbush, for those of you who know Brooklyn. And I told my Haitian grandmother I was going to be going to Spelman. She was like, but why can't you go to Brooklyn College? You don't even have to pay for like the bus fare. You could just like walk over there. And I don't know, as a Haitian American, I had gone to high school with a bunch of Caribbean people. Like all mm-hmm. of my high school was from the islands.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I love dance, so I love everything Caribbean. But I definitely love African American literature.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up loving Langston Hughes and loving Zora Neale Hurston and loving Alice Walker. And I wanted to be in that world.
Right.
I had scholarships to other places, but I definitely wanted to go to Spelman. And so for me, it was like this fantasy. Like, and I got there and, I, you know, there's a friend of mine that, Jordy Patterson, we talked about a little earlier. Mm-hmm. I was there on a school trip. And I was the first person in my family to go to college in America. And I get to Spelman campus, I'm visiting. And there's a woman in all white and she has books on her head.
And she has what?
She has a bunch of books in her head. Like,
books?
Yes.
On her head.
On her head. Spelman's campus. And I go up to her. Like she was in Africa
somewhere.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on. All white, gorgeous woman. She has like a ton of books in her head, like walking around with the books. I'm like, so I stop and I start talking to her. And she's giving me that look of, please leave me alone. But I'm a young, eager person. This gorgeous woman is walking around with books. And she was pledging an African sorority. And they had a vow of silence that I forced her to break because I was too eager.
She's like, motherfucker, what do you want?
And she became one of my, you know, sort of best friends and good, you know, just someone who led me through school. But Spelman was like that. They had the Greek life was definitely strong, and I've learned to appreciate Greek life a lot more. A lot of my friends at Delta, AKAs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But there definitely was an alternative.
Right. And you were there at Spelman, and we talked about this a little bit. But from what I gather, you were there during this era when I would come through Atlanta and visit friends of mine who were there. And it was a very artsy, shea butter moment. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? That was like the first, you know, we had a few African-Americans that were wearing dreads. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
But I had dreads at 16. And at Spelman, people used to come up to me and be like, hey, so do you wash your hair? I was hostile, but, you know.
But at that time, it was like, you know, all these kids had locks. And,
natural
you know
hair.
And they, you know, it was backpack hip hop and, like I said, bees, wax, and incense. It was an amazing world to me. I was, you know, I didn't come from that. And I didn't.
Where did you come from?
I came from hip hop, bebop, Luke's Club, Strawberries. You know what I'm saying? Blue Iced Teas, Heineken's. Mm-hmm. You know, Trues and Vogue,
Dirty South.
You know what I'm saying? Ragtops, Benzes and Jags. You know that type of thing, like real street life. Mm-hmm. So to see that, it was like an amazing that these kids were creating this world. You know what I mean? And you've seen a lot of that backpack stuff on from New York, but to see it happening in Atlanta in a way that they made it their own with people who I knew was like, man, they created a whole nother
way of being.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, Saul Williams came out of that camp and Sean P.
Yeah.
And I worked a lot with Sean P. He's like my DP.
He's cool. Shout out to Sean. What up, Sean? This is Dana.
So Sean P., it really helped me out with my business now. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know him then, but, you know what I'm saying, to know that he was connected to that thing, I knew, you know what I'm saying, he was about something. Mm-hmm. So being there, what was it like?
I loved it. I mean, Spelman gave me everything. And I already come from a family that gave me everything. Mm-hmm. So it just enriched me further. Like, I think that I'm really interested in sort of like having spaces for young people that allows them to just be, to think about ways of being that's not just commercial, that's not just about consuming. And I love my professors. I mean, the other day I was in the middle of packing, unpacking, decluttering. And I'm opening letters, like recommendation letters my professor sent when I was applying to graduate school. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to read them because they were just too nice, too positive. But it takes a village. And I worked three jobs while I was at Spelman. Let us surprise you. For those of you in Atlanta, let us surprise you. It might still be open. It was lettuce, muffins, $6.95, all you can eat.
Muffins?
Yes. Soups. So it was definitely.
And what was the name of the place?
Let us surprise you.
Let us surprise
you. Yeah, the lettuce part. It was a soup and salad place.
Okay.
So I lived in College Park. I lived in Midtown for a while. I worked on campus. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Spelman was, I'm friends with a bunch of folks who went to other schools. Mm-hmm. And for me, Spelman gave me that sort of small college feeling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with what's happening today, it was a women's college, historically black women's college. So that's not, you know, an unimportant fact.
No, that's a very important fact, especially now.
So I went to a historically black women's college, you know, Janet O'Cole.
That's interesting because it is a historically black university, and we can, you know, it's one of the elite ones. But I never actually thought about that it's a historically black woman's college.
It definitely is something.
Nice. I mean, not that I didn't know that, but just to hear it in that form, that's an important statement.
No, it is. I mean, people have all kinds of ideas about what makes people stronger. And I think Spike Lee had it when we were colored. It's like the reality is when people are young and trying to figure out who they are, mm-hmm. an environment of love and nurturing is the gift that keeps on giving.
Right.
And so, you know, people say, well, you know, you shouldn't go to a black college because the world is not black. You shouldn't go to a woman's college because there are men. But the reality is, you know, women who go to women's college are often stronger in general in the business world and ideas and writing and assuming their place next to men. Mm-hmm. And black colleges, I was a wannabe journalist even back then. One of the things that helped me go to...
Don't deny yourself. You're writing, man.
I was working for something called New Youth Connections back then.
New
Youth Connections.
New Youth Connections.
Yeah. It's still out as Youth Communication. Mm-hmm. And every single writer right now who's a writer of color who's from the 90s has been affiliated with this organization. Because if you wanted to write in New York in the 90s, this was the place to be. Mm-hmm. But I did an article about historically black colleges. And it turns out, even though less than 20% of black students are at historically black colleges, but they graduated far disproportionate number of that. Mm-hmm. So this idea that going to historically black college is going to be a deficiency for you is just wrong.
Oh, we already proved that wrong. That's more bullshit.
Yeah, there you go.
So for me, you know what I'm saying, being in that environment, one, you get to discover, one, the different kinds of black people that exist, mm-hmm. other than just, for me, the people in the Northwest Dade mm-hmm. County. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So now you're in there. You're somewhere in this world, this ecosystem of blackness, trying to figure out who you are and be who you are and, you know, where do you stand in this scope of blackness, right? Mm-hmm. And once you realize that, hey, I'm good in my blackness. I'm black as they come.
Yeah.
And I'm good as the goodest blacks.
Yeah.
And I'm cool as the coolest blacks.
Yeah.
And I can make it out here. I'm good.
But it's also being around a whole bunch of black people, like that's the other thing. Different types of black people can thrive. There's mm-hmm. not one way of being black.
so the thing what I discovered once I got into the world, especially when I got to New York, is that they can't tell me who I am. They can't say what I can't be or what I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know when it comes to the scope of the people who I come from, I know where I fit. I know where I am. I know which pieces
That's
are
lovely.
Good and what works with me. And I know I don't have to change that when I come around Matt.
That's a right? power. That's powerful. What up, Matt?
I like to think I'm a pretty accepting person anyway, so.
You're like, I'm hardly the test here.
So when I go meet your mother, I'm going to be cool, and she's going to be cool, and she's gonna be like, you know what? That's a cool motherfucker right there. You're like, maybe. Woo! I had no comment.
Man, I'm Jewish. I'm practically, I've played discrimination in my background.
Jewish women love me.
Okay.
Is that not in that kind of way? But
are you coming out to my mother?
No. What I'm saying is, in my line of work, I work with a lot of Jewish women.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? In the beauty and the fashion, especially. And my first big clients that were at Estee Lauder, I had three Jewish women that I had to work very closely with. And turns out, my temperament works with the stereotypical Jewish woman's temperament from the outside looking in. I can't say all Jewish women are the same, but a lot of them that I've encountered have a certain temperament.
He's smiling. He has ruddy cheeks.
They have a certain temperament that when I come, you
and
know,
a big, big beard.
When I work and I do my thing, it works. We work together very well. And I was shooting, I have this one family that I shoot a lot of stuff with. And Jewish couple,
mm-hmm.
and I see how they work together
mm-hmm.
and how they roll and how she does her thing with him and to him and then how he responds.
I notice how you said to him, right? I see you being a man here.
What?
How she does her thing to him.
No, I said with him and to him. Like, no, it's a thing. It's a certain thing. It's a wife thing. It's not a woman man thing.
I got you.
It's a wife husband thing because my wife do it to me as well. But the way he handles her is the same way that I would handle my wife. And mm-hmm. I was like, ah, he, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So it's a certain thing. I don't know what it is, but I usually work well with Jewish women. That's all what right. I'm saying. So your mother might, you know what I'm saying, make me a monster soup or something. You know what I mean? But anyway, back to black.
Back to black.
Ask me something.
No, I mean, so you went from FAMU. How did you discover that this being in advertising was in your talents?
Advertising, that didn't come into play. So, like I said, I had a TV show in college, which had some similar.
Oh, that must have been fun. Was it a talk show or a feature show?
It was like a magazine style show. Mm-hmm. We interviewed entertainers when they came to town, or we went to a town where, you know, mm-hmm. some rappers or singers mm-hmm. were at. We played videos, maybe mm-hmm. one or two videos, mm-hmm. and we visited black college events and mm-hmm. campuses, and we wilded it out. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of wilding out, a lot of talking to the, you know, saying the other co-eds, but it was also, you know, talking to the SGA president mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. what was going on. Mm-hmm. Like, our first show was at Tuskegee, mm-hmm. and they had, you know, Tuskegee has a great homecoming, so... We did the homecoming, and then we also talked to the SGA president, who was in the middle of an uprising.
Of course.
He's like, the administration. So,
I remember that uprising.
So it was like a great first show, and yeah. that was kind of the template. We
fun
get a
little, with resistance with fun.
Yeah, we get a little history, you know what I'm saying? Then we cover the scene, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? We party. We show a little video, and we interview some rapper or singer or mm-hmm. whoever.
So arts and culture show, basically.
Yeah.
Or culture and politics show.
Yeah, and it was a great time. So I guess we had advertising in there. Mm-hmm. But when I came to New York, I was at Vibe magazine.
Mm-hmm. That's when Vibe was hot. Is Vibe still around?
Yeah, they're around.
Okay.
They're a website.
Okay. Online.
Not, yeah. This was when, you know, it was...
Whoo. People used to wait for that cover.
Yeah, like, first time I saw Vibe magazine, I was selling reefer.
Okay. Admission, as a lawyer, I would say you were not selling anything. By reefer, you just mean fun stuff.
That was a long, long, long time ago. Party materials. And I went to... That's when beepers. I had a beeper. I answered.
Not a Sky pager, a beeper.
No, before Sky, I had a beeper, just a beeper. You know what I'm saying? You had to do the codes with the numbers upside down and all that. But I went to, you know, go take a package somewhere, and I was there, and they were talking. You know, it was one of these crews that, you know, is very cultured. They were like all from D.C. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were playing music, and they had locks, and mm-hmm. it was one of them era. One of those crews.
One of those parties I might have been at.
Yeah, you would have definitely been there. And on the nightstand, on the little coffee table, they had this big ass magazine with Tretch with no shirt on.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
And I'm like, what the fuck is that? So I picked it up, and I'm looking at it, and the first thing I could remember thinking is that I've never seen hip hop look like this.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And present it in this way.
Yes.
Black and white picture, big
photography.
You know what I'm saying?
Just gorgeous angles.
It was a moment. It changed. It changed mm-hmm. what I believed was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it changed my perception of how things work. Mm-hmm. So fast forward, I ended up at Vibe magazine. Mm-hmm. Because Keith Klingscales went to FAMU.
Mm-hmm.
He was the CEO at Vibe.
Nice.
And I'm there, I'm working, I'm in the marketing department, and a job in sales opens up.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a job, I'm doing all the entertainment sales, which is music and TV and film, so those ads, and I'm selling ads. I don't know shit about selling ads, mm-hmm. but I knew how to solve problems.
Mm-hmm.
And people weren't willing to buy music ads at that time because mm-hmm. the music industry was kind of going down.
Mm-hmm.
So I made all of my money through solving problems, creating opportunities for artists to kind of get into our ecosystem and flourish.
Give me an example.
So I think one of my favorite examples is Young Jeezy.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So Young Jeezy was about to come up, and at Def Jam, there was a marketing exec named Ashana Ayers,
mm-hmm.
who works with Mary J. right now. But we were real cool, you know what I'm saying? She would always, you know, listen to, you know, my little solutions that I'm trying to give so I could get some ads money. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And she would always call me when they had something new. Mm-hmm. And Jeezy was something new that they had. He was on his mixtape. Mm-hmm. What can we do for Jeezy? Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, listen to the joint. Oh, I like what he got going. So at this time, we had a festival that we were doing in Atlanta. Then my big thing was Yard Fest. So we created this college tour called Yard Fest, which the first year we did it at Howard. Mm-hmm. Jay-Z performed, mm-hmm. and it became a legendary thing. They actually still do it in mm-hmm. at Howard. Mm-hmm. But it became a legendary thing. So we had Yard Fest, and then we had the Vibe Award Show. Mm-hmm. So I had like a whole string of things that Jeezy could do.
Products,
and
yeah.
And we ran Jeezy. At first, you know, nobody was really with it, so we kind of snuck him in. Shout out to Ludacris and Shaka Zulu, because mm-hmm. on our festival, the execs didn't really want to put Jeezy on that. Mm-hmm. But Ludacris
yeah.
put him on his bill, and he yeah. came out with Ludacris.
That's
so
cool.
Then once they saw it work, then by the time the award show came, he was big. Mm-hmm. A few months later, he was big. And so that was a great example. But then you also have examples of like Rafael Sadiq. Mm-hmm. When Rafael Sadiq came back solo after being, you know, away for a while, he was looking for ways, and I met his manager on some crazy ass serendipity.
New York moment.
No, it was actually we was in Tennessee at a hotel.
Oh, that's very serendipity.
At a Impact Music conference or whatever, mm-hmm. when they were doing Lucy Pearl, mm-hmm. and I'm Ali Muhammad. Mm-hmm. Ali Shaheed Muhammad was in Lucy Pearl. Mm. I'm in the bed. I'm asleep. The loud ass hotel phone ring. And and this lady's on the other line, like, yo, you got to be downstairs. I'm like, who is this? She mm-hmm. was like, Ali, you need to be downstairs. I'm like, who the fuck is this?
That's funny.
I don't need to be nowhere. Click. Phone ring again. She's like, what are you doing? I'm like, yeah, you must be calling the wrong person. Who are you looking for? She was like, Ali. I'm like, this is Ali. She's like, Ali Muhammad. I'm like, this is Ali Muhammad.
Oh.
What, do you need to be downstairs? I'm like, yo, I'm Ali Muhammad from, oh. She was like, oh. And then we figured it out.
That's funny.
And then we talked. And then it was like, cool. And I met him when we went out to LA. I met up with them, and then Rafael Sadiq was coming out with his solo project. Mm-hmm. So we figured a way. It was a lot of trickery involved, because I was also doing music supervision on films.
Trickery.
So I was like, you know, can you make me some songs for this movie? Mm-hmm. And he was like, you know, that's cool. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Well, what we got to do? Mm-hmm. I'm like, cool. So he was making these songs. I didn't have no budget to pay him. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, if you make the songs, then I get you an ad in the book, and mm-hmm. then I put you on mm-hmm. this event thing that we got going. And I didn't know how I was going to do that. Mm-hmm. But it worked out.
But it worked out.
It worked out, and Rafael Sadiq did the showcase like right when his album, it was basically his New York album release. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it felt good to help push that, and then that album became a legendary mm-hmm. album. It was like, you know, so little things like that, you know,
little moments
that
seizing them, you're prepared,
right? It's not like you're making a career, but you're providing a little bridge, and those little bridges is what got me ads. Mm-hmm. And basically I made money mm-hmm. through the ads. Mm-hmm. So that's kinda how it worked.
You were being, you were consuming.
That's my whole thing, though. My whole thing, like when you say being, way of being, my whole thing is to get to being. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? And, you know, a lot of times you come up with this thing in your mind of who you want to be mm-hmm. and how you want to be. Mm-hmm. But none of that matters until you actually are.
Yeah.
You know,
enjoying
what I mean?
The process while you're at it.
You are one thing. And so each stage I go to, because, you know, it's always constant growth. Mm-hmm. Everything is growth. Everything is retooling yourself, and you retooling, recalibrating yourself. Mm-hmm. But the core purpose of it is, okay, this is who I'm going to be. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be it mm-hmm. before I'm going to say it.
I love that.
You know what I mean? And once you are it, then, you know, the Jewish ladies are really like
you. Because you're living your truth.
Because, yeah, you're just in it. It doesn't matter. Like, when you come up on people, like, in groups, you know what I'm saying? I'm not one of those people that say race doesn't matter and people don't see race and color like that, because that's a lie. Mm-hmm. But when you are in a solo situation, one-on-one with somebody, and it becomes human to human and not politics and groupness, it's your way of being that that they're going to read. And a lot of times...
Well, if you have compatible values.
Well, even if you, if you're incompatible, then a motherfucker, they're going to understand whether or not, you know, who you are and where you stand.
Fair enough.
And whether or not, you know what I'm saying, this motherfucker might whip my ass because...
Or might be able to help me.
Or might be able to help me. Or you know what? I don't have to agree with this motherfucker, but right now
I respect him.
We gonna drink this wine and be cool.
I like that.
You know what I mean?
Like we're drinking and, this wine right now.
And that's off your being. Because if you're wavering, motherfuckers gonna push you.
Yeah, like kids and dogs.
Exactly. And my daughter pushes me all the time.
How old is your daughter?
9.
Is this your only child?
No, she's the baby, and she know our waivers, and she like, yeah, I got
you, motherfucker. She knows our waiver. It's so cute. She's your only girl?
Yeah, 2 boys and a girl.
Okay.
Yeah.
You waver with her.
I definitely waver. It's sad.
I love it. She's going to be a strong lady.
I hope so. I feel sorry for her lover.
She's going to be nothing but kind.
I doubt it. But okay. You have kids?
I don't have any kids.
All right, so let's talk about this writing.
All right.
You know what I mean? What's up with it?
Well, you know, I think I'm a poet. And I feel for a very long time I wanted to be a novelist. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, just recently I've been reading some Emily Dickinson. I was like, you know what? This woman was happy being a poet. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a poem she wrote, My Letter to This World. It's like 8 lines. Mm-hmm. And it's given us 100 years of pleasure. And I think I say I struggle at writing because sometimes I think we don't take the pleasure in the moment. Like,
right.
It's always like, oh, am I going to sell this? Am I going to publish this? It's like, I'm at this point right now where I'm just like, no, you know what? I'm going to take pleasure in putting phrases together and capturing moments.
Are you doing that?
I am doing that.
Nice.
I am doing that.
And when was the last time you were really happy with something you wrote?
I always say you're only as good as your last poem. So I might want to pull it up for you. But it's too long. I think I'm happy whenever I'm able to say something. I think the last time I was very happy with something was in the fall. So last year, that's a long time.
No. I mean, cause you know, sometimes it takes like that. Mm-hmm. What does that feel like? Like do you feel it when you write it or do you feel it when you read it back?
I think both. I think when, you know, I was reading recently, somebody was talking about muses and, you know, we all want the muses to sing in our ears and, mm-hmm. you know, leave our mouths. I think the times that I write and the reason I say I struggle to write is because I write out of pleasure, out of passion. Mm-hmm. And I think real writers write out of discipline. That is, it doesn't mm-hmm. matter if the muse are not talking to you. Every day you get up and you do 4 hours.
Right.
So that's my struggle. But for me, I think when I sit down and I'm able to capture a moment, it just comes. Mm-hmm. And then the editing comes later.
Right.
But you don't struggle with that.
Right.
It's like, when that happens, it's not just about writing, it's about being. You're like fully lived in the moment. Mm-hmm. Like whatever it is you want to say, whatever it is you're struggling with. And you know, I think the reality is, even if you never publish not one thing, and I think all writers out here feel the same way, it's a moment where you get to be like this deep, honest version of yourself. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that's the struggle.
Now, this is one, I'm going to ask you this and then I'm going to tell you why.
Please.
I ask you this. Now, do you write that honestly to other people or just to your paper?
You know, it's funny because I'm talking about Emily Dickinson, and she didn't spend any time socializing with people. All mm-hmm. her writing, like this letter to this thing that she says, the letter to the world. Mm-hmm. She took pleasure in writing letters to people, and part of her poetry was in letters to people.
Right.
So
to
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I definitely feel like I've cultivated some deep friendships mm-hmm. from Spelman, from my life over the years. And those friendships have been kept alive by vigorous communication.
And do you write to them like you write to yourself?
At this point of my life, I would say yes, because I'm very clear about so many things.
Right. No, no doubt.
So the gap closes. Like, at this point, you are who you are.
Right.
And that's who you're going to be.
And I only ask you that because I don't do a lot of writing. I haven't done a lot of writing. I used to write a lot, and then I didn't write a lot. I always write. I always keep a journal, and I always write in it when I have ideas. You know what I'm saying? But it was very personal. Nobody, I didn't talk to anyone like I talked to myself. You know what I'm saying? The voices that I hear and I put in my journal is a whole different language than what I speak. You know what I'm saying? For a long time. I took a project where we were creating content for a client, and it was more than just video content. It was just social media content that needed actual writing. And in that process, I found that if I use the voice that I use to myself in this work, it came out a lot better, and I became more confident in writing, and I became more I became better. Like you said, you cultivate better relationships. So I extended that to my business communication. So in my emails, in my texts, or if I'm, you know, just saying happy birthday or whatever, I try to talk in the voice that I talk to myself to, as That's opposed to the filtered voice that I use to the world.
I mean, I think I've just been lucky in that I have people who I really respect and love who happen to also be writers. I mean, Ki'ini Salam, I'm going to give her a shout out. She's a good friend of Sean Peters. And she has two short story collections. We've been friends for a long time. And just the other day, I'm going through some decluttering. I'm like, wow, I used to write her long letters. We used to write each other long letters. Like, I've met her at Spelman over the years. Like, women, we're not lesbians writing each other long letters.
Really?
Yes.
Who assumed that?
what do men say all the time? Oh, he's cute, no homo. She's brilliant, no lesbo. I started saying that to my friends. But but I say that in part because what's interesting is that in having really great quality friends, I'll write something to them, like I'll just talk. I have a lot of opinions. And she'll write me back and say, that should, you should just, you know, tying this up and send it off to this and this thing to get published. And so I have not been aggressively trying to get published, but I've had friends who've encouraged me. And what's interesting is, unlike you, like, I don't talk to myself. I don't want to talk to myself. Let's just be clear. But I do, there are people that I want to communicate with, and that's turned into journal entries for me. So I, you know, I'm constantly having conversation. I mean, I'm a loner who's enjoying conversation with a whole lot of people around the world.
No, no doubt. I don't think I talk to myself. I'm not that kind of person. I think God is talking to me, and I'm just filtering it out.
You're very spiritual.
You know what I'm saying? That's what I think is happening. I mean, that's to me, that's the voice of God I be hearing. Because I be saying shit that, like, I don't even know what that word means. And then I would look at it, I'm like, oh shit, I'm using
it was
right.
It was the right word.
Boy,
right.
You good, boy. Right. You need to be like
but
this
but
in real life.
But I think there's different writing going on. I mean, there's polemical stuff, like all the opinion pieces and the ideas. And I think that's critical in terms of, like, the discourse, the conversation. But I think, you know, there's also the creative writing, the writing that is just sort of like capturing this moment, capturing an emotion, and after you've lived the hell out of that emotion.
Right.
And I think those are two different kinds of writing.
Well, like I said, I don't even know what kind of writing I be doing. You know what I'm saying? I'm no writer. I just write in my journal. And then I write captions on my Instagram and shit.
No, I mean, I appreciate people who are writers to their journals. I think I've become a writer in part through my friends because I've been getting that positive feedback from my friends. Right. And it's been wonderful because I love their writing.
So what's the, where do you see... Where do you see yourself?
Oh my God, that's that job interview question.
Definitely not a motherfucking job interview
question. People say this to me all the
time. This is real life. This is just conversation.
I mean, honestly, I don't know. I think I'm in a, I'm not an optimist in today's times.
Okay.
I think the Trump presidency really troubles me in a great way. But I also think, you know, black folks, when has it ever been easy for black people?
I felt like we prepared for this shit.
So, you know, it's like, when has it ever been easy? So I don't know. I really don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I could give you a story, but I'm not going to do that.
I mean, that's what we're here for. We love stories. I tell stories all the time. You want to hear stories?
Tell me stories.
I mean, shit.
Tell me about your 9-year-old daughter. What's her name?
My 9-year-old daughter's name is Molly.
Molly.
Molly with an A.
Is her mom's name start with an M?
Yep.
What's her mom's name?
Malita. And her great grandma's name is Molly with an O. So she's Molly with a goddamn A. Because we weren't, no, I'm just
That's
talking
cute.
Shit. So Molly is 9 and she's in the 4th grade. And she's
came
been,
to America in the 4th grade.
And she's been here before. And she knows things that she shouldn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And she does things that, you know, is not, she shouldn't be doing. Right now she's slinging slime at the in the classroom in 4th grade. So she's making it and selling it. And she just came, you know, Daddy, I want to sell slime.
What
I got,
does that mean?
I got orders.
I don't have kids. You have
slime
to break this
Slime is
up
like
me.
The gooey stuff.
Yeah,
that
as
you,
in the blob?
Like blob, like green. And it's a big thing now with the kids that are making it.
Oh, so she's a marketer. She's like.
They're making slime. So
she's an entrepreneur.
Exactly. So she's going to sell her slime. So
Pretty
she came
soon
home.
She might help you out.
No doubt. So she came home yesterday with a sheet of names of people who ordered slime from her, and she said she has customers she needs to get the slime to, so she needs to go to the store to get these ingredients.
She got deliverables,
but she ain't got no startup money.
That's her daddy fund comes in,
you know what I'm saying? Actually, that's her mama fund. Her mama did it, her mama put it together. But she went and slung the slime. Like, she made 12, she had 12 containers of slime. She sold 10.
That's so cute.
She ain't make no profit, but she ain't worried about that right now, and I ain't worried about stressing about
it. I have a little niece, Analia. I have to give her a shout out. Just a month ago, she got on YouTube, The Magic of Kids.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at her YouTube channel today. She had like 8,000. I was like, how do you have 8,000 people watching one video about you unpackaging cute little things your father buys you?
Exactly.
She's 8.
Exactly.
We didn't even know about YouTube when we were 8. You were like, you had to wait till college to have a TV show.
Right.
I call kids today GMO kids, genetically modified organisms. They're on the next level.
No doubt. So, you know, that's what they are. Like, she draws. She's been drawing since she could hold a pencil, and she could hold a pencil when she was about 18 months.
It's her thing. It's her nature.
And she's been drawing women in dresses since she was about 2 years old.
Mm.
So she's a fashion person, and that's what she does. And, you know, hey. So she's cool.
She's cool.
Yeah, she's running
Molly
around,
with an A.
Pushing me around and stuff like that. But, you know.
You know, one of the things I really love in terms of writing is I'm going through this phase right now, the dear self letters, mm-hmm. the dear daughter, dear future self, dear past self. Like, what are some of the things you would want to tell your daughter in a letter for her to open in 20 years?
I think about that a lot.
Well, she's 9. Let's say 15 years.
I think about that a lot. And I you know, it's so much that you want to put down and you want to say, but then at the same time, I'm like, you know what? I'm not even going to worry about that right now, because in 15 years, it's going to be a different kind of world.
Mm.
It's going to have a lot of different challenges, a lot of different things that she's going to be faced with. Now, I will say that, you know, I try to, you know, pick out little things now that, you know, I'm like, you know what? I want her to be able to believe in herself and her talents and in her who she is and be centered.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But then at the same time, you don't know what kind of, you know, where she's going to bump her head at. So you don't know where to shore it up. I just know that I'm going to be ready and prepared to have, you know, that feedback and that shoulder and those words to give her, just as I do with my friends. Because like I said on here before, I don't really deal too well with little kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? As far as conversation. My conversation ain't kid friendly. It's not a, you know what I mean? It's
you don't modify.
Nah. You got to have a little bit of heartbreaking bills to be able to deal with the conversation that I'm going to give you. Like, even some people on the podcast, they be like, well, this Ali be tripping. But you know what I'm saying? Once you experience life and you done bumped your head a little bit,
mm-hmm.
I'm a gem. I'm the mm-hmm. goober. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? I'm whoop, whoop. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? I'm first call, you mm-hmm. know? Like, you know, it's old people call me, you know what I'm saying? Young people call me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm ready for that. And I'm prepared for that. So when she gets to that space, mm-hmm. and some kids get there before others. Like my 13-year-old, he's different. He's in a place where you could hit him with the Willy Bobo,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean,
mm-hmm.
right now,
mm-hmm.
and he can understand it.
Mm-hmm.
My teenager, you know, he's 17, you know, he understands some of it. You can hit him with some of it, but then some of you got to pull back a lot because he don't understand all that yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with her, I don't know. I don't know when she's going
to
get
there. Well, are you in her world, though? I'm hearing a lot about her catching up to your world, but...
No.
Are you in her world?
I'm in her world. I live in her world now. Like, when she catches up, that's what I'm saying. Okay. I could kick in. I live in her world right now.
It's her world.
I'm dragging her down. I'm chauffeuring her to the store, buying supplies for dollhouses and slime and, you know. So, right now, I'm in her world. Her world, I'm just letting her thrive. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And she's you know, making her clothes for her dolls. And, you know, yesterday she built a dollhouse over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So she went to the Michael's Supplies and she bought all this shit, you know, to make this dollhouse from YouTube that she saw this lady that makes dollhouses and stuff.
Cute.
So, so she came back, she built it on Sunday. And she put it up, and then she had her dolls in there, and then she set it in my office. I don't know why she set it in my office, but it's there. She leaves to go to school. She's like, "Daddy, make sure you feed my dolls and make sure they get up and eat." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And then she was like, "And I'm going to know if you didn't do it if they're still in the same place." So I'm like, "Oh, shit."
So let's say fast forward. She's 21 years old. She's like, "Daddy, I want to be an actress." I think I'm going to have an audition with someone who's really important in this business. They want me to meet them at a hotel. What do you think I should do, Daddy?
All right, let's go.
Oh, you be going with her.
Nice. Hey, let's go.
Nice.
Shit, I'm going to be the manager. You know what I'm saying? I'm ready. I'm prepared for all that shit.
Got you.
All that right there. That ain't no motherfucking problem.
Got you.
I worked in this business
for a minute.
But and I like I said this on the show before too, because it's concerning to me. Not even for the guys who like Harvey Weinstein that are doing shit like that. It's just a precarious position. Cause I shoot, shoot fashion, and with one photographer, I shoot swimwear and lingerie fashion. The first time we went to Petite Saint Vincent, which is a private island by Barbados, southwest of Barbados or something like that.
You saying Saint Vincent, the island?
No, Petite Saint Vincent.
Petite Saint Vincent. Okay.
So it's a different. Different than St. Vincent. So it's a little island. It's just a resort.
Small St. Vincent.
It's a private resort. So we're there shooting, and then Nina Agdale, she's a big model right now. She's a Sports Illustrated somewhere. She was the model, and we were shooting like 3 days with her, and she's like 19. And she flies from wherever the fuck she's from to this island. And... she's by her fucking self. No manager, no agent, no nothing. She lands by herself. You know what I'm saying? We land. We were the crew. We were crewed up. You know what I mean? But she comes in. She's by herself. And I was just, you know what I'm saying? And then we got there. It's like no cell service. You can only get cell service at the, you know. Actually, we was in Tulum. We were in Tulum. And it was no cell service. You can only get cell service right at the lobby of the hotel. And it's like, man, would I want my daughter to just show up on some remote ass island solo dolo?
Don't know nobody.
She just, you know what I'm saying? This is just a new crew. And this is her life. This is what she does every day. And it's like, you know, not that anything's going to happen, but what if it was a Harvey Weinstein on set? You know what I'm saying? That's like, what could you do? Your phone ain't working. You out here by yourself in a foreign country. It's weird. And I don't think I would want my daughter doing that kind of shit. You know what I mean?
Most reasonable people wouldn't.
So, you know, I would, you know, I that's why you have these momagers and stuff like that. But, you know, it's just it's a weird lifestyle in that, you know, you're very young. You already are commoditizing your beauty.
Yeah.
And that's what the lead is. And... you're here, you're with a group of people you don't know what's going to happen. You can see that moment when you're trying to figure out who's who, what's what, where it's going to come from, how it's going to be. And then I'm the solo black guy. And it's like, you know, the 6-foot black guy with the video camera. You know what I'm saying? That's always
going to be precarious.
That's always precarious. And it's always like, I call them the heroes that's going to save the young model from the black guy.
We want to hear about
I don't understand like what I'm supposed to. I'm gonna just jump. You know what I mean? Just run through the set.
That's interesting. But how did a hero show up?
Well, I get there. I start shooting. Like I said, it's lingerie or swimwear, or whatever. You start shooting, and what the client wants, they want all of it. So you know, you start shooting before they come out on set. So they're in their robe, they're getting hair and makeup. Mm-hmm. So you're waiting for a certain time to get their hair and makeup, and then. You know, sometimes it's the hair person. Sometimes it's the, you know, somebody. Like, when you come back there with the camera, and then and the model is in the robe, it's somebody that's saying, wait, what's going on? Why are you shooting back here? Behind the scenes? This is behind the scenes? And you know, I've learned, you know, I don't pay attention. I just keep shooting. I do what I do. I shoot. And then the process is... Okay, the main photographer, he gets ready. You know what I'm saying? He comes by. Hey, Ali, what's going on? Hey, man, what's going on? Yeah, all right, yeah. Blah, blah, blah. Then the client comes. Oh, Ali, you made it. Da, 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 da. Ooh, did you get everything? Yeah, I got it. You know what I'm saying? It's all good. And so it's nothing that I have to say to the heroes, but the heroes watch the interaction. And it's like, oh.
Okay, he's okay. He's been vouched for.
By lunchtime, it's... Who's the black guy? Like, who are you? Like, where did you come from? What do you do? Like, what do you mean, what do I do? You see what the fuck I do?
I'm doing it right now.
Exactly. I'm doing it right now. So it's just, it's an odd sight and it's a very awkward dance, but I know how to do it. And that's where that being and that presence comes in. That's why I say it like that, because I came to do my thing and I'm going to do it. And then it's a certain way of being that I come into the room with that. It's very disruptive at first, but then once it all levels out like I know it will, once it gets to the equilibrium, then it's like, everybody's good. Like, you know, he fucked me up at first, but now it's all good. You know what I mean? So that's why I use that being thing. I learned it shooting Jane Lauder of the Estee Lauder family. She was the president of Origins, and she kind of gave us our first big cosign. And we were shooting her for the promo, and she was very nervous. And like I said, it had nothing to do with race or nothing like that. It just had to do with being. She was very nervous. She couldn't get the lines out or whatever. And you know, the people that were working in the company, they were kind of nervous that, oh, shit, James is
nervous. Energy,
like,
right.
Okay. But it's like, you know what, Jane? Everything we're asking you, you already know. You know what I'm saying? And it wasn't the words that I'm saying. It's the, I'm going to break my whole, I'm trying to break my physicality all the way down.
Black men have to do this all the time. I have so many black men friends who are tall who constantly are like slouching, like this internal slouch.
And it's not a slouch thing. It's like you're trying to break yourself into particles, not that's like bend down and be low to her. It's you're breaking yourself up so it's only energy left. And
that energy is
now the energy is, you know what? You fucking billionaires. You know this shit. You know this shit better than all of us. I know this shit and I don't even work here. You know what I'm saying? Now just say it back. You know what I'm saying? And all you giving is light. And all you getting back is reflection. And that makes the product good. That makes everybody feel a certain kind of way. And in that very moment, it's a very, you know what I'm saying, harmonious situation. Now we might go in hallway and be like, this motherfucker here, she'd see me on the street like, oh shit.
Yeah, but you know how to get the product out.
But in that moment you break it down, and it's like, I don't know how to use that in the regular world. I don't know how everyone could use that to make a situation a situation.
Everyone can use that. That's even on the train ride. I took the train up here. Trust me, there's energies all the time. And I think aggressive kindness is something to practice. You know, going out of your way to like say, hey, don't worry about me. I'm not here to like fuck up your space.
Oh, I might be here to fuck up your space. You make up your mind and decide. Because you need that too sometimes.
Not necessarily on the train on my way home tonight, but yes. No, but I think sometimes, I mean, I've seen it. I've worked in corporate America. And as a, you know, if you're a black woman, there's this thing where a black woman will come into a room and the one other black person won't talk to you.
Right.
And so you have to go out of your way to sort of say, hey, it's okay. There can be two black people here. Mm-hmm. It's this constant sort of like breaking stuff into particles. Like, I'm not a threat to like to your life.
See, those kind of people, they need something different.
What do they need?
I get them something different.
I don't know. I kind of like my approach. Because
No.
I definitely work. I go out of my way to make black folks in corporate America feel like they could say hello to me.
You have your way.
Right.
I make them feel like you ain't got to say a motherfucking thing to me. Because we're going to be here. And I'm not going to stress you about it. Right. I'm going to say hello three times. I don't get no response.
But that is still being aggressively kind.
But guess what's going to happen? It's the same thing as the heroes. Because
over time, they will say hello.
Not over time, they will. Over time, they're going to see certain things. There's certain things they need to see. They need to see that. It was one dude at the private school my son was going to at one point.
In New York?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was one black guy. Never speak. We get in the elevator. It's me and him. What's up? Mm-hmm. Good morning.
That's exactly the energy I'm talking about.
And I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with this motherfucker? And then, you know what I'm saying? You'll see him talking to, you know what I'm saying, one of the rich parents and shit. And he's like, mm-hmm. like, oh shit, he could talk.
Mm-hmm.
Then
you know this is I but, know but this it's energy.
Cool. You don't have to say a motherfucking thing to me, and I ain't gotta say nothing to you. We're gonna be cool. I ain't gonna give you no negative energy, I'm just not gonna give you anything. But what's happening is everybody else that's feeding off your energy, hey, good morning. Like, you know, you come in the lobby, like, you know what I'm saying?
He's like, well, how come I'm not part of this party?
Yeah, exactly. Now it's like, oh, shit, how you do that?
Right.
And then it's, you know,
right.
You want to figure that out.
Right.
But I don't like that.
Yeah. No, I mean, some friends of mine hold a grudge. I've moved past it. Because no. I think this is something that capitalism, like, creates. You know, whenever people feel very competitive, they feel like everybody is like in between them and their food and their belly, whether it's their kids. Like there's this energy that I think a lot of times, like the one black person in the room syndrome, mm-hmm. when there's a black person number two, it's like a thing that they have to negotiate.
Well, that's their problem.
That's right.
I ain't worried about it.
That's right. That's right.
So, you know, I know you're not on social media and shit like that. You know what I'm saying? Put any writings out in the world? What can people find your writing?
I mean, you know, a couple of years ago, right after the Haitian earthquake, I did edit a mm-hmm. book written by young people, all from Haiti. Just different stories young kids had written over the years, and I edited it. So it's out on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I've definitely worked around young people in writing my whole life.
Right.
But this is the beginning of my own writing life.
Right.
So no, I am not a published author. You can't find me on Amazon.
Can't find you nowhere. But you did find on The Conversation, a hidden gem, you know what I'm saying, right here.
But that's that black family that we have, right?
No doubt.
Yeah.
Word
that's
up.
6 degrees of separation family.
6 degrees, hey, if you educated a black, is one.
Yo, speaking of which, I had a friend who used to say that, Van Jones. Some of you may know him. This is one of the first things I learned from him.
What?
If you're educated in black, you know you have, you're one person away from knowing that person.
Exactly. it's very simple.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? What school you went to? Oh, you know.
Yeah.
Bam. Yeah. You know.
That's why you can't go around misbehaving. It's just, shit will follow you.
Yeah, that's hey. This time, this day and age, shit.
It will follow you.
You can't go around misbehaving. You got to be 100 in your misbehavior. If that's what you're gonna do, that's what you got to lead with that.
What's being 100? Oh, being transparent.
You have to. This is who I am.
Got you.
You know what I mean? Because they gonna find out.
Yeah, but people who misbehave, they need non-transparency. That's what makes it fun for them.
I think the old version of that. I think the new one's just gonna have to be like, you know what?
Hey, this is who I am.
This is who I am. Like Harvey Weinstein. Wow. He from the old school. He from
the old school will be offended.
No doubt. But I'm just saying he's from another era.
Yeah, he's from predator land.
Yeah, and then, you know, there's always been those. You know, it's always been those kind of guys.
Always.
So, you know, he ain't new.
He ain't old school, though, because I think old school charm. I think old school protection.
Well, that's another side of the game. Yeah, it's always going to be. There's still charming guys. Yeah. Like, motherfucker, yeah. I ain't one of them, but you know what I'm saying?
Right. His stuff is not old. Well, it is old school in that way. Old school predators will be proud.
Predators will be predators. You know, some predators gonna pray.
Right. Predators are gonna predator. They're gonna predate.
They're gonna pray. Pray by however the fuck we go supposed to say. You know what I'm talking about.
They're gonna predate. I don't know if that's the word, but I like it.
Yeah, but they're gonna predate, and you know, but now his predation gotta take on a whole new form. They fucked him up.
Yeah, he must have made somebody pissed.
He did something to somebody. He did the wrong thing.
For a long time, he did the wrong
thing. I mean, of course, he did it for a long time. But, like, well, I wonder what was the catalyst this particular outing?
Why would, if somebody said, you know, if you had to guess for $1 million, you had a shot, would you have a shot at that $1 million?
What happened now?
If somebody said to you, you know, take a guess as to why now, why would you guess?
I would lose $1 million because I wouldn't even know where to start.
What about you, Matt?
I don't know.
All right, for 1 million, Dana.
No, I really don't know. I mean, I was a history major, so like a lot of times there's like a favorite word that I love from history is this notion called watershed. So mm-hmm. It's just like, I mean, when the levees break, something happens, but it's like that dime and then boom, all of a sudden the Empire of Rome fell. Like, I don't know what that catalyst was.
Yeah.
I really would love
Brutus.
To know. Somebody knows. Because 30 years, this person sort of like preyed on young women around town. That, right. That's a long career.
I mean, Bill Cosby had a long run too.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it might just be in today's day, anyone has a microphone. Anyone can put things out there. And then just get enough people out there and with a present is everyone's hyper vigilant right now. So,
but this came with one piece,
the New York Times, the New Yorker piece.
So it came with this piece, and somebody ordered the piece. Somebody said, "You know what? I'm gonna do this piece on Harvey Weinstein."
Well, it could just be. I mean, it could just be that someone had kept hearing things. Everyone knew that Harvey Weinstein was a scumbag. Mm-hmm. That was never in doubt. So eventually, mm-hmm. someone's like, "You know what? Why don't I write about this?" It's just there's no necessarily one thing. It was just, okay, I've heard enough. It's time to actually write this.
But how do we go from last year around this time? This was, we didn't know the name of one Harvey Weinstein victim to now we know like nearly 50.
Well, I mean, once it drops, then, you know what I'm saying? Then
everybody comes out.
Then everybody, that's the same thing happened with Cosby. You didn't know. Mm-hmm. You was fucking Jell-O pudding pops
mm-hmm.
until it was 75, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, it's pretty accusations. Scary. It's pretty scary.
And, you know, now in the different industries, you know, the cultural leaders and the thought leaders in those industries are asking, you know, who's the Harvey Weinstein of our industry mm-hmm. so we can get ahead of this and mm-hmm. be responsible mm-hmm. and, I would say, reactionary. Because
mm-hmm.
why you ain't do that shit last year?
Mm-hmm.
Year before. But we could be reactionary to what's going on and proper with the times mm-hmm. and on the right side of history.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be interesting.
Well, and that's also assuming that Harvey Weinstein is the only Harvey Weinstein of Hollywood. I'm assuming there's probably others.
No one assumes that.
This is a very sliding scale of Harvey Weinsteins of very different flavors. I'm sure everybody's getting right with their people. Like, listen, hey.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always troubled. I mean, it's always the troubling cases, right? Like, you know, it's like we grew up in this sort of like sex positive, like feminism, like, or even transactional sex. Like the reality is Harvey could have had sex with anybody he wanted to have sex with at any time.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you ever see him?
No, there's transaction though.
Oh, transaction.
Like, yeah. But a straight up, pure, honest transaction. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I'm here for a reason, you're here for a reason. And we were both part here having have had reasons fulfilled.
Right.
And so same thing with Bill Cosby. So these people who can actually afford anything in the world, they can afford sex, they can mm-hmm. afford lots of sex.
Mm-hmm.
They choose to take it in the most humiliating way possible. And to me, it's like there's something about that I can't get over, that it really does come back to sex is not about sex.
Let me ask you something. So with Harvey, you saying
he could have bought sex any given day of the week. He could still buy sex right now and had his little sex.
I guess he felt like he was buying it by...
But that's not, no, this is called manipulation. Like whenever you have somebody's time under false pretenses, like if I'm here to audition for a role, I'm not selling sex. I may be selling my sex appeal, But I'm not selling sex. There are people that are selling sex.
No, no, he's not saying you're selling sex, but I have a transaction here. I have, you know, this career for you.
If. No, they all have a career for you, right? I mean, this is sort of like the power imbalance and dynamics. I mean, I feel like the metaphor that explains so much to me is something from my grandmother, which is, if you go visit a black man and the man is blind and he has $100 on the table, mm-hmm. the person with character doesn't walk out with $100 just because the man is blind. Mm-hmm. So, you know what I mean? Like, there are always going to be young, vulnerable women who want to get ahead.
And boys.
And boys. And that's the truth be told. A lot of boys.
I'm sure it's probably more boy Harvey Weinsteins than...
Yeah. And it's also the double thing about men can't talk and men don't have that. Just, you know, it's actually even, in some way, probably more burdensome to be a young, pretty boy. But the reality is there are people... Character does matter. Character right. matters. Right. You know what I'm saying? So it's just troubling to me. Like, I think out of all the stories I heard, the story that kind of stuck with me the most, that I felt it brought up a lot of women are saying me too for a reason, mm-hmm. was a reporter who... She said, I didn't need anything from this dude. I didn't need anything from him. I was out in the town with my friends. He came next to me. We started talking. He was charming. I was like, oh, my God, here I am, a young reporter talking to Harvey Weinstein. Mm-hmm. And the next minute, he's saying, hey, let me give you a tour of my restaurant. Mm-hmm. She's thinking, oh, this is a restaurant. I'm going to go see a working Manhattan kitchen. There's not a rat in the place when she goes to. And somehow, this motherfucker is, like, masturbating against her will. And he says, he doesn't try to, like, when she's not really going to go for whatever he had in mind, he says, just stand there. And that's like, you know, if you go back to Ralph Ellison's sort of Invisible Man thing, like, this is like this essence of non-being. Mm-hmm. I don't even need you to participate in my BS that's going to affect you profoundly. I'm going to disrespect you because I've determined you're not someone worthy of respect because I don't respect anyone. Right. And I feel like you show me a misogynist person and you probably find a racist. So I'm not buying Harvey Weinstein and his like hug of Barack Obama. I'm not buying that. This person doesn't respect human beings.
Right. Because everybody can be bought.
He doesn't respect human beings. Like, this woman doesn't need anything from you. Forget the right. starlets that actually needed a role. This is right. this woman you meet in a restaurant. And I'm thinking, I was just out the other night. I can't imagine some guy chatting me up at the bar saying, I own this restaurant. Do you want me to take you for a tour? The next thing I knew, I'm locked in some basement and he's whipping out his penis so he can, like, pleasure himself. Like, that's just a profound, not disrespect of me, but of humanity.
Right. And you're not on social media, so... Yeah. From what I understand, that happens in your in the DMs of a woman's, you know, inbox.
Well, Anthony Weiner, anyone? Yeah, like, what was Anthony that about? Weiner. Like, you're married to this beautiful woman who's going places. You go in the New York Times doing your mea culpa, and somehow the New York Post can sting you? I mean, and it's like Anthony Weiner, Harvey Weinstein, this whole, like, and you men, you tell me. I mean, I think Howard Stern said it best. No woman wants to see a man's penis.
What is but some of them do, I guess.
No, as a man, a man, if she haven't asked you for it, if consent hasn't been, hey, right. send me a picture of your penis, don't do it.
But no doubt. But it's saying, I don't know.
Don't look up old friends from college, but hey, what's no. up? Like, don't do it. It's ridiculous. Like, women, we don't operate. I mean, they're outliers, and mm-hmm. I am just one woman, so I speak for no one. Mm-hmm. But as a general rule, I don't think we operate the way men operate. So whatever you want as a man, mm-hmm. don't think that I want it. Like, think carefully. Like, you want to receive naked pictures of women. I don't need to ever receive naked pictures of a dude to be happy. I just don't. And I will find it very bizarre if someone who I don't know, I haven't sort of sought that out from him. Yeah, I mean, Anthony Weiner, what did he get out of that? Besides his 21 months, I don't know how long, of like, I mean, he's like now a convicted sex crime
right,
person.
Right, but didn't he carry on a relationship with that person after or during? After,
I don't think there was any face-to-face meeting. All of this was via social media. Just compulsion for him to share, like, his wiener, Carlos Danger. I mean, come on. There's something completely... I mean, we keep using the word narcissistic a lot mm-hmm. in this society, but there's something...
Sociopathic?
I'm not a therapist. I don't know enough to say that, but I am touched by the profound lack of respect in these interactions. And I think where there's abuse, it starts with disrespect. And for me, that is sort of like the root of all kinds of unequilibrium relationships, whether it's racism, misogyny. Like, it's all the same. It's just like, you are not as good as I am because I said so. Mm. How do you whip out your penis to a strange woman you've never met and somehow think that would at all be something that she wants? And also to know you could do that without any consequences. And there were none. This happened 10, 15, 20 years.
So for him, the numbers don't lie.
The numbers don't lie.
I whip it out 100 times and they roll with it 98.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a sense of, like, if I had a little girl, it's a complicated.
Why are we bringing up little girls?
No, because you have a little girl.
Go ahead.
No, but you also.
I don't want to talk about that.
No, my bad.
Go ahead.
My bad.
No, I'm just playing. I do. Go.
But it's something that I question, like, wait, these very wealthy and successful people stay silent for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And on some level, it's like they let this predator prey.
Right.
And so, like, it's like we're all complicit in this.
Right.
Like, weird,
it's
yucky
crazy.
Feeling. I feel dirty just thinking about it.
I don't, like, again, like, I've been out of the game for a minute. But it was this time in the crack era when the money was flowing, everything was rolling.
So was the misery.
The misery was flowing. But it was just this time where you saw the effect of money. It was the first time I saw the effect of money. And being young and watching, you know, older relatives and older, you know what I'm saying, getting money. And you see people who tell you every day one thing about, you know what I'm saying, don't, blah, 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 blah. And then you roll up to the light in the Benz of the, you know what I'm saying, the older one. And then you see this teacher from your school pull up thinking it's them.
Mm.
And they're like, hey, and then it's you. And it's like, hey, what you doing?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, hey, where's Silk?
Mm-hmm.
Why you want to know about Silk?
Because I want to know about Silk, that's why.
Why do you want to know about Silk? And it's in my mind, it was like, yo, this is the craziest, like, it's the craziest thing out. And it's, you know, I had friends who, you know, who parents may look at me and judge because, you know, I came from that kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll judge you. You know what I'm saying? They're like, you know, stay away. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, mm-hmm. I ain't that one right there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm doing good. I've got good grades. You know what I'm saying? I'm doing my school thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And then to turn around and see those same parents copping, you know what I'm saying, from my people. And it's like, wait a minute, how you, that's the dope man right there. What is he doing?
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And they see you and they wondering if you know what they doing. And of course, I know what you're doing.
Mm.
I know what you're doing. That motherfucker right there ain't got no friends.
Mm-hmm.
He only got, you know what I'm saying, clients.
Mm-hmm.
So if he here and you here.
Yeah,
you know what
it's
saying?
A transaction happening.
But I also know the rules. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Happens in this house, stays in this house, everybody business ain't nobody business, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
All that. You
mm-hmm.
know what I mean? So, hey, that's what you do, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
Keep it moving.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see them later and they looking at you like, is he gonna bust me out?
Mm-hmm.
Nah, I don't got no reason to bust you out, man. Mm-hmm. That's what you gotta live with you.
Mm-hmm.
But then that's when I saw that whole concept of
knowing and not knowing.
Knowing, not knowing, but a person that is judging and casting this judgment.
Mm-hmm. The hypocrisy.
The hypocrisy of life.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I learned.
Mm-hmm.
The hypocrisy of life. So we have all of these rules and we have all of these things that people say, but then you have all of these things that people do. And the way that people actually are being
mm-hmm.
is a lot different than what a lot of people are saying.
Mm-hmm.
And for the people that are keeping it straight and narrow, you know what I'm saying? The people that flip-flop on it fucks it up for everybody.
No, I mean, I definitely, you know, we're complicated beings, you know, and if you're going to be complicated about what your favorite color is,
mm-hmm.
even if you're a fake vegetarian like myself, I eat eggs. Don't tell nobody, but people do know.
Well, you know, my partner here, D Lemon, he was vegan for a couple of weeks, but we went to Philly and we had them cheese steaks.
And he was over it, right? So, I mean, my thing is, if your hypocrisy is sort of your struggle with yourself,
right,
that's one thing, like who you aspire to be versus who you are.
Right.
There's always going to be a gap unless you're right. like, you're that person. Unless,
right.
I don't even think the Buddha has reached that. Like,
right.
I think that's a sweet gap of growth.
Right.
This is who I want to be. This is who I am. Mm-hmm. This is who I want to be. This is who I am. The blank page, I want to be a writer. Let's fill it up. Like, that's like a struggle that we do all the time.
Right.
But I guess for me, we use big words to really get away from something that I think is a simple principle, which is respect.
Mm-hmm.
And like the Cosby situation, the Wiener situation, the Weinstein situation, these people don't respect other human beings.
Right.
Like, there's a profound lack of humanity in their presence.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't matter how many causes. Doesn't I mean, I went to Spelman. There was a building.
They gave a lot of money.
$20 million the Cosby building.
I don't know. They're like, what the?
No, it's a cognitive dissonance, you know? Mm-hmm. But I just believe in that. I think the root of abuse is disrespect. It's the root of abuse in personal relationships, is the root of abuse and political relationships. Mm-hmm. Like 3/5 of a person, that means I don't respect you as a human being.
You beneath me.
Yeah.
My dog.
Yeah.
Is better than you.
And so, like, to me, this is like on the disrespect equilibrium. It's on the same wavelength for me. And
no
there's
doubt.
Something profoundly disrespectful about this human being. And it's not even about, like, all his friends, like, as a man, I'm concerned about all the men who say, I didn't know Harvey Weinstein was doing A, B, C, and D. Like, you're a grown man. You
right.
have a read on all your male friends.
But, you know, it's interesting because you say that and you might know a guy that's tripping, that likes to trip.
Mm-hmm.
And it's where I think now with what we have going on here with the revolution of communication and hearing the stories and seeing both sides of the game. Because before things happen, you might know your homeboy, you hear his side, that's it. Social media and the hashtags, you get to read the opinions and viewpoints of thousands of people at one time and get a more rounded response at a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
And then it starts to turn kind of like the same voice. Then it's that voice. A lot of that type of communication is new, and that type of understanding and recollection is new. So it's like, say in college or something, you got a dude a homie that's tripping. You know what I'm saying? He just running through them like, ha ha, I got mad chicks everywhere. Mm-hmm. Having my way. And
it's a totally difference between a hoe and a rapist.
No, well,
but go
no,
ahead.
I don't know no rapist, so I can't even go to that level.
I'm just saying, but what people do under consent is totally different from what people do under coercion.
Right. But so you might say, you know what I'm saying, you hear things about that dude, maybe he beat women. You know
mm-hmm.
what I'm saying?
That's real.
You ain't never seen it, but maybe he beat women or whatever. And it's like, where do you... What is your responsibility?
Yeah.
Like before, it was like, I don't know.
No,
you know what I'm saying? Now it's kind of like a situation where you had to reconcile that thought. Like, it was this one time, scared Monique, and we're gonna wrap it up in a few.
Okay.
But Monique, I'm not gonna say her last name, but she went to elementary school with me and junior high. I know her from all the way up. And, her mother was a teacher at our school. And we were probably like in 12th grade and she was dating some, she was in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And her boyfriend was a big time drug dealer and she was real cool with my cousin. And we were at a club and this guy was beating the brakes off of her in the parking lot. And it's somebody I know, you know what I'm saying? This is somebody like, and it was sad, like the whole parking lot was sad, but it was like, what do you do?
What did you do? I mean,
you couldn't
young.
Do. I mean,
it's difficult.
This motherfucker's a known killer.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, you watch, and it's like, damn, oh,
you
shit.
Feel ugly.
And you kind of just slink away. But
you feel complicit.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, you're complicit, but what is the responsibility there?
I for me, I think that's a much more interesting conversation than another adjective being thrown at Harvey Weinstein. As far as I'm concerned, right. Forget that dude.
Right.
He's done. But there's an entire community that was complicit in that. What's our responsibility?
It was a whole parking lot of people.
Like, I feel like, and that's the kind, and even me, even like, even if I was a woman on that couch waiting for my future in his hands, mm-hmm. if he attacked me and I walked away and I said nothing, and I took money. Well, what does that mean? Like, there's a conversation everyone needs to be having. And I think the quicker we just, the less Hutter is named no more. Like, this utter his name no more. Let's go back to like, wait, what is our responsibility to each other and to ourselves and to the mm-hmm. person that's coming behind us? Like, do I send somebody to a meeting with that dude after he attacked me?
I don't think he's gonna be having too many meetings.
Well, but that's the same thing with Cosby, right? It's we can feel good about ourselves collectively when these lions are in winter. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not at the apex of their career. Like, Bill Cosby was not on NBC when these allegations came out.
He was old.
You know, this wasn't Shakespeare in Love, you know? Like, he attacked Gwyneth Paltrow during Shakespeare in Love, and you know what? She went on to have an amazing career. Mm. And so it's just like, you know, we're attacking these lions when they're a little bit in winter. And that's cool, but a whole new crop of women are getting... These lions are... They're not... Man. And... Fair enough. A whole crop of
in Hollywood, people. It's a trip. Yeah, you know what I'm saying. I, you know,
but it's not just Hollywood. I think it's in. I mean,
I'm just saying in Hollywood, it's a trip.
Because I mean, I feel like working in an industry where what you look like doesn't matter. As a lawyer, who cares what I look like? Right. But it does matter.
Right.
You know, so it's happening. This level of like, who can you respect? Not respect. It's a question of respect. And some people are feeling like respect is something they're gonna dole out, like some divine shit when. Really, you know, this is quote Mos Def, you know, you're valuable because you are.
And I guess that's our theme of the night. Be because you are.
That's right.
And y'all can catch me at Mr. Muhammad on Instagram.
All right, Mr. Muhammad.
Thorough TV at Thorough TV on Snapchat. We'll be back next week. D-Lemon will be in the house.
Hello, D-Lemon. I didn't meet you, but hello.
Dana, you know what I'm saying? Any last shout-outs, parting words?
Shout out to all my peoples from Spelman College, Morehouse, the AUC, to all my loves. You know who you are. So, to the 90s.
To the 90s. And we out. Tell a friend, and even the enemy to get in the conversation.
Of it all is to be in the conversation.